You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Being a member of the European Union comes with rights and benefits. Third countries can never have the same rights and benefits since they are not subject to the same obligations.
Michel Barnier, the EU's Brexit negotiator, says no to cherry picking and highlights the unity of the 27 remaining member states. My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Matthew Green will give us their take on this and the day's other top stories, including Hassan Rouhani's warning to President-elect Trump over the Iran nuclear deal. And in Brazil, the Senate's president is forced to step down over corruption charges. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Matthew Green. Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University, and Matthew Green is a journalist and author who previously covered West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan for the Financial Times. Oscar and Matthew, welcome to you both. We'll begin today's programme here in Europe and the latest developments on, yes, Brexit.
People talk about the sort of Brexit that there is going to be. Is it hard, soft? Is it grey, white? Actually, we want a red, white and blue Brexit. That is the right Brexit for the United Kingdom, the right deal for the United Kingdom. I'm ambitious for what we can achieve.
The single market and its four freedoms are indivisible. Cherry picking is not an option.
Red, white and blue Brexit. Matthew Green.
I'm all in favour, I just like to say. I think it sounds like a great idea. If someone could explain what it is.
Yeah. Yes. Shouldn't we have a green one?
Yes.
I guess there are two things here. One is this issue of, is this anything other than a slogan, another vacuous slogan to add to Brexit means
collection.
Brexit. But actually, isn't there also something else going on here, which is essentially trying to wrap up being pro-Brexit in the Union Jack, in the Union flag, and saying true patriots are pro-Brexit?
Yes, well, we have all had a kind of good chortle over this this latest phrase, red, white and blue Brexit. It does sound a bit like something out of a parody news site, doesn't it? But it is 2016, so anything is possible. But yeah, it does sound actually like quite a calculated comment designed to appeal to those many people who are wanting Britain to leave the EU as soon as possible, perhaps UKIP voters and others on the Tory right. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's trying to appeal to that kind of patriotic sentiment.
Oscar, this has become, it's funny she used the phrase black and white or grey and white, but it has become quite a black and white issue. This suggestion that because 52% of the population or voters voted one way, therefore there can be no giving in to the minority on this. Brexit means Brexit. We'll wrap ourselves in the Union flag.
Oh, it's a terrible mistake. I mean, the whole thing was complicated enough, but to wrap it up in, the flag and so on is just a complete misdirection. This is an example of deflecting. Somebody who's writing for the government has been having too many colours on his diet. We've heard gold, silver, bronze, blue, white. And in fact, the real black and white situation here is, as the EU chief negotiator put it, there are rights, there are obligations. You cannot have your cake and eat it. So some hard decisions are really coming.
Michael, Matt, we heard there from Michel Barnier, the EU Brexit negotiator there, who was giving his first press conference. He was saying that the other 27 member states are united, and in a sense they are, in that they all want a good deal for themselves. Do you think Britain should be worried by that? Or do they think, OK, look, this is actually just talk, and once we get down to it, we'll be able to peel away some support?
Well, there does seem to be competing imperatives, doesn't there? Because obviously, on the one hand, the EU bloc can't afford to let Britain walk away cost-free, because certainly the kind of core members are so concerned about the whole project unravelling. But obviously, on the other hand, nobody wants Britain to sink without trace, because that's not going to be helpful for Europe. I mean, I think the real question is one of timing. I mean, Article 50 is supposed to be triggered in March next year. From what Michel Barnier is saying, there's only going to be about 18 months clear to negotiate. And it seems like every one of the much maligned experts who know anything about these kind of negotiations is saying that that's nowhere near enough time. And the real danger is that whether we want a hard or soft or red, white and blue Brexit, we just kind of crash out and fall off a cliff without really having any sort of comprehensive deal in place.
Oscar, does it matter if there isn't a comprehensive deal in place? Is there a way that, you know, we can muddle through a little bit and try and find something that works? And, you know, if we've only got 18 months, well, we've only got 18 months.
Unfortunately, the process is so messy that my prediction is that that's exactly what is going to happen. Yeah. We're going to have, I think the key in what we have heard today is in the so-called transitional period. We're going to have a pretty long transitional period in which many things will appear to change and most things will not change. I've been told by many in the civil service that they have already revised most of the legal issues, which, you know, if true, you know, they do deserve our admiration. But in any case, many of these of the conclusions of this revision do point towards the fact that most of these things have to stay in place. You know, issues like passporting rights for the city and the very impact of some directives and so on and so forth. Those are not things we can do away with in 2 years. So the transitional period is what we're going to get. We're going to get an appearance of regaining control of immigration. We're going to get many appearances. We're already getting only appearances. But I'm afraid that the substance is going to remain pretty much the same.
Matt, as well as a new slogan today, there were a couple of other things that happened in the Brexit arena. One was that we entered day two of this court case at the Supreme Court, where various citizens have been taking the government to court, saying that the decision on when to trigger Article 50 needs to be taken by Parliament. Parliament is sovereign. That's now being heard at the Supreme Court at the moment. And it also, at the same time, it seems that the Tory government led by Theresa May has accepted a Labour Party motion that the government will publish its plan for Brexit before it invokes
there is a plan.
Article 50. Well, we will now see.
That's assuming there is a plan.
Blue, exactly. Red and white.
We will now see what this red, white and blue plan looks like, because they have said, fine, we will publish a plan.
Well, that's right, because, let's face it, up to now, the whole thing has been a debacle, hasn't it, really? I mean, I don't know how many days it is exactly since the June referendum, but we've had this incredible sense of drift in all that time, with different ministers coming out with different statements, infighting in the cabinet. We had a leaked memo from a consultancy a few weeks ago saying that it would take 30,000 civil servants even to be able to handle Brexit, and that there was no plan. I mean, the whole thing has been really... It has not been a very uplifting moment for the British government. So there's obviously enormous pressure coming, mainly from Tory backbenchers rather than Labour, which has obviously got its own hands full with its own sectarian struggles and hasn't really put any real meaningful pressure on the government. But yeah, the question is, what is in the box? What is this plan? You know, let's hear it. All kinds of different messages. And the tone has changed a little bit, hasn't it, with David Davis coming out and saying maybe the government will be prepared to pay towards single market access. So there's all sorts of cards or things on the table. How to square the circle between what Michel Barnier was talking about, the rights and the obligations of Brexit, is still really a question, isn't it?
And Oscar, there is this other aspect here on the European side, where we heard Michel Barnier talking about the indivisibility of the four pillars of the European Union, one of which is freedom of movement. Mm. Now, speak to anyone in Brussels and they'll tell you, well, this is part of, you know, our founding documents, it's part of our founding principles, there's absolutely no way that we can move away from this. And yet, speak to ordinary people across Europe and you won't get necessarily such an enthusiastic response to the idea of freedom of movement. It's quite possible in the next couple of years, particularly given the elections we're about to have in Netherlands, in France, in Germany, that Europe, you know, led by its people, may start to change its view on that big issue of freedom of movement.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, that's exactly what I meant when I said we're getting appearances. Yes, we're hearing about no disunity and core principles. But in fact, what we see is that the EU is at risk of unraveling or beginning to unravel. And also, at least one of the core principles, that of freedom of movement, is already being revised. I mean, we're already seeing, massive tidal electorates pushing the agenda elsewhere, which is why one can predict that the deal we're going to get is going to give Britain the appearance and some measure of controls on immigration. And let's be frank, you know, what really matters those in Brussels has to do more with the stability of European finances and the banks. So those things are being taken care of, surely to the detriment of, the liberties of those moving around Europe. But if that is the case, then we must conclude that the EU, as we knew it, is really disappearing.
Matt, there are some hardcore Brexiteers who
certainly, in this office,
who certainly wouldn't. I think that's unlikely, given the international nature of our office. But who certainly wouldn't shed a tear if the European Union were to fall apart. Mm. And in some ways, you know, that may be what they're pinning their hopes on, is that, you know, in 2 or 3 years' time, there won't be much of an EU left to do a deal with.
Yes, because when you look at the likes of Nigel Farage or Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, yes, you just see
the Bruges group.
This visceral, yeah, kind of hatred, this sort of contempt and kind of fear and loathing of anything to do with anything across the channel, don't you? So I definitely think there is that strand of political forces who would be more than happy to see the EU unravel despite the enormous damage and chaos it would cause. But it was interesting, wasn't it, to see Angela Merkel today at her party conference taking a much tougher line on issues around migration, saying that the burqa should be banned or face veils should be banned in Germany. So it's... I think Oscar's right. There is this real kind of identity crisis taking place in Europe at the moment. What does Europe? What does Europe mean? What does it mean to be part of the EU? And we're going to see that playing out for years to come.
Well, indeed, just to move on to that briefly, Oscar, as Matt was saying there, Angela Merkel speaking at the CDU conference in Essen today, she was renominated once again with, I think it was sort of 96 or 97% of the vote. So, she remains a certain level of popularity within her own party. But she was taking a noticeably harder line on some social issues and saying that she said where it is legally possible, she wanted to ban the full veil in Germany. When you have statements like that, and you have in France the probable contender against Marine Le Pen is François Fillon, who has said he has no problem with religion, but he has a problem with Islam. We're starting to see a different sort of Europe, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. Liberal Europe, Europe that stood for its post-war and Enlightenment values, is on the wane. And actually, we should be very concerned about it, because this is now a global phenomenon. We have a movement not to the right, but to something that looks entirely different. This so-called alternative right, or as others would say, neo-fascist tendencies are beginning to take root. And in spite of what happened in Austria, we see so-called moderates reacting towards these developments in a way that makes these a much more problematic issue. And as you pointed out, it is very unfortunate that the left has not been able to muster a clear response.
And so, Matt, when you then look at, to go back to the Brexit negotiations, this is really why it's so crucial that they work for everyone, that there is still a strong relationship between Britain and the European Union, that there is a deal that helps keep the unity of the European Union, because that then means you have some sense of stability and hopefully economic security across the continent.
Yes, and the kind of paradox at the heart of all this is that actually the majority of the political class in Britain doesn't want the country to leave the EU. It's merely, I mean, obviously the referendum vote was as it was, but there's so much concern in Westminster about what this could all mean and where it could lead, that there is kind of going to be a tremendous sort of institutional desire to kind of limit the fallout from all of this. But I guess the question is, when the negotiations get down to actual brass tacks, whether both sides will be able to sort of maintain the decorum. Certainly Michel Barnier's initial tone was very conciliatory and diplomatic, but whether that will be possible to be maintained as the clock is ticking, it really is, I think, a big question.
Okay, we'll pause right there. When we return, we'll be talking about Iran and the nuclear deal and what impact President-elect Donald Trump may or may not have on that. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests, Matt Green and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, will be here after this.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Matthew Green. Let's move on now to Iran. And today, President Hassan Rouhani said in a speech broadcast live on state television that he would not let US President-elect Donald Trump rip up the nuclear agreement between Iran and world powers, adding unspecified repercussions if that happened. Before we get into the deal, Matt, and whether it can or cannot be ripped up by one nation or another, I guess it's important to point out that Iran has its own elections coming up in June, and Hassan Rouhani obviously wants to be re-elected. And often we talk about Iran as if it has one view on the world, and actually there are a lot of different competing views going on, particularly surrounding this deal.
Well, that's right. And the interesting thing is that Iran has actually been quite measured in its response to Trump's election victory. there's quite a strong strand of opinion in the Iranian political class that actually the country does better under Republican administration, or certainly its relationship with the US works better during a Republican administration than under the Democrats. So it seems to me there's a lot of room for sort of deal making, which will be good for Donald Trump. And I think you're right. Whether they can actually rip this deal up, really, it's really certainly not clear that Trump is going to sweep into office and on day one revoke the Iran nuclear deal. I think that would be pretty unlikely, to be honest.
And Oscar, when you look at what's going on inside Iran, there are still those tensions between the more conservative elements of the government and the regime that were uncomfortable with this idea of a deal in the first place because they felt that they were giving up too much.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, I think that particular element is going to weigh heavily upon the American administration. Mr. Trump would be wary of strengthening the hand of the conservatives within Iran. He's not the people with whom he could or would like to make deals. And insofar as that is the case, he's going to toughen up the rhetoric. But I agree with Martin here. I don't think he will destroy the agreement at all. He might, again, a lot of rhetoric, and Trump is very, very high on rhetoric. And he will toughen up the stance, make the U.S. appear as the strong negotiator on the table. But it would be most inconvenient for them if, as a result of this, they end up strengthening the hand of the hardcore political part of the political class in Iran.
And Matt, you've also got this issue that, as we're saying, this is not a deal between Iran and the United States. It's a deal between Iran and the United States, France, Germany, UK, EU, China, and Russia.
Yeah.
It's all of whom...
Yes, there's a lot of vested interests in keeping the deal alive. And, you know, I also wonder, you know, just even thinking about any foreign policy question in the new era of Trump, whether our normal rules of rational analysis just don't go completely out the window. I mean, I look at the team he's assembled to take over in the White House, and you think that within about 5 minutes, they'll have fallen apart in kind of infighting and sort of scheming. I just wonder whether it's possible to make any kind of prediction whatsoever about how Trump's going to behave.
Well, which
is in a way a good thing. I mean, maybe it won't be as bad as it looks.
The one thing we've heard is that there is a certain interest in lowering tensions with Russia, particularly vis-a-vis Syria, and that might indicate that things with Iran will not hot up. Particularly because this is, you know, of no less concern, the Trump team seems to want to toughen up the U.S. stance vis-a-vis China.
The people who voted for Trump, I don't think, I wasn't in the U.S. during the elections, but I'm willing to bet that most of them were not voting to rip up the Iran nuclear deal. That was not high on the list of priorities for Trump's base. So we can hope that maybe with the Paris Climate Agreement, which he's also pledged to rip up, this will kind of be left in the sort of too complicated box, at least to begin with. And maybe, just maybe, they might both stay in place.
I think that'll be the case because, you know, climate change is something that does matter more. But the real deal here is China because there is this idea that China has stolen the jobs of people in the Rust Belt.
Yeah.
So that's going to figure more centrally.
It was interesting on the climate change issue that he was meeting with Al Gore,
went to meet Ivanka Trump, his daughter, who's obviously probably going to basically be running the country from all we can tell, which is maybe a positive thing as well. So, I mean, this is why it's so appalling to watch, but fascinating as well, because it is so unpredictable and so difficult to figure out. And, you know, I just get the feeling somehow Trump just kind of wants to be liked by people. I mean, I think it was, who was it who said
he's a narcissist, of course he does.
America's greatest ally is whoever Trump's on the phone to at any particular moment.
Well, we were discussing last night on Midori House about the call between President-elect Trump and Nawaz Sharif, the Pakistani Prime Minister, which the Pakistani Prime Minister's press office had very cunningly basically transcribed and released, where Trump is talking about what a fantastic guy
wonderful,
he is.
Exclamation
You're amazing.
Mark.
Pakistan is a wonderful people. As we were saying again last night, you know, perhaps no one had pointed out to him that Pakistan is on the whole a Muslim, given, you know, the praise that he was heaping on this country. Oscar, then, in a sense then, you know, you were talking before about, well, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric and he's very good with rhetoric. But the fact that the structures are in place of how the world works on the whole, you know, can we rely on the fact that those are quite hard to rip up, whether that is climate change, whether that is the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, I think some international structures are more resilient. I'm more concerned actually with U.S.'s internal structures. I think, you know, everybody keeps saying that, you know, there is a separation of powers there and that will control or normalize Trump. I'm not sure that's going to be the case, but I think it's going to be more difficult for him to have his way in the international arena.
Okay, let's move on from Trump. Let's move on from the Middle East and let's head to Latin America and to Brazil, a country that in fewer than 100 days has ousted its president, the head of the Chamber of Deputies, and now the president of the Senate. Last night, a justice on Brazil's Supreme Court removed the powerful head of the Senate from his post as tensions had escalated between Congress and the judiciary over efforts by legislators to curb the power of prosecutors and judges overseeing corruption investigations. Oscar Guario Rivera, is there anyone involved in Brazilian politics at a senior level who isn't tainted in some way?
Well, of course, the key word there is in some way. There are those who have been unjustly ousted. I'll come clean here. I don't think that Dilma deserved to be ousted. If anything, what has been proven is that she was ousted by a cabal of white corrupt men, and that's it. They have been falling one after another, as predicted. The problem here is that.
When you say one after another, six ministers have been forced to resign.
Absolutely.
since what, May?
And this is just the beginning, because as we know, the acting president is also in trouble. And that's the issue. Brazil is beginning to look a lot like Argentina during the time of El Corralito back in 2000. You remember that the slogan in the streets was "Que se vayan todos," you know, to hell with all of them. And that's precisely what we saw a day ago. People on the streets claiming for the process to pretty much bulldoze the entire political class, which is seen now by most Brazilians as totally corrupt. No differences being made. The problem, of course, is that the price is the cost is going to be very high. The country is very unstable, politically very unstable. Every single attempt to stabilize the country economically, there is no time to do so and no place to do so, because they're all going or gone.
Matt Green, when we look back, say, 7 or 8 years ago, Brazil was having something of a moment. It was going to host the World Cup. It was going to host the Olympics. When you were based in Africa, pretty much every capital you went to, there was a new Brazilian embassy.
It struck oil,
opening up.
And although they'd found large oil reserves as
and
well.
It felt like a country that was on the rise and becoming a true southern power.
Yeah, that's right. And that narrative really does seem to have clouded, doesn't it? I mean, it's pretty amazing, isn't it, to think, a third of members of Congress are somehow under investigation? That's a pretty high proportion of the legislature to be facing kind of a criminal investigation. And it's always sad, isn't it, when you see these success stories? I mean, we love in the media, don't we, to kind of write the narrative of suddenly, you know, Africa rising, or Brazil has turned the corner, or the country has somehow changed. But so often it proves to be a little premature.
And Oscar, the big problem here is that we have this huge political issue as you say, people losing faith in their politicians at the same time as the economy is tanking.
Which is not a particularly Brazilian problem. This is the global trend. We're losing faith on our politicians and the political structures right at the time when we need the strongest channels for collective decision in order to fix the economy somehow. But this is as it must be. We all predicted that after the economic crash, a political turmoil will follow, and it has followed.
Okay, on that not wholly uplifting note, we'll end today's programme. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Matthew Green, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, by Helena Geriat and Naomi Joseph. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Stay tuned for Section D. That's at 1900. Markle Daly at 2200. Midori House back tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.